everyone, and welcome to Book Hype. My name is Karen. I'm joined by my co-host, Kristen, and today we have an extra special episode for you guys because we are interviewing Diane Ackerman, author of The Zookeeper's Wife. Hi, Diane. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Nice to talk with you.
It's great talking to you, too. We both read your book in anticipation of this interview, of course, and the movie adaptation will be coming out March 31st, which is why we got to do this awesome extra special episode of Book Hype. So we're really excited to see the movie, too. We haven't gotten a chance to see it yet. We're hoping we could see an advanced screener, but didn't work out for us out here in Ohio, unfortunately.
Well, I've seen it twice already, and I can tell you it's absolutely beautiful.
That is high praise.
Yeah. I was very concerned, of course, because the Jabinski children are alive, and you want the movie to be true to the story of the family, and it really is.
Very cool.
That's great. So I wanted to kick this off by asking you a question we usually talk about at the beginning of every Book Hype episode, and that's, what books have you been reading lately?
Oh, well, I read a lot of books simultaneously. It's just irresistible. So at the moment, I can tell you what books are open. I'm reading The Nature Fix. I'm reading a book by Donna Seaman about American women artists, Identity Unknown. I'm rereading Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, and various other things. I have essentially two main libraries, and I've just gone into my wet library. That's the books I read in the tub. Yes, exactly. So, Hortense Kalischer's Age. Mary Oliver's book about her sweetheart who passed away called Our World. And Annie Dillard's Abundance. So, those are just a few. But I tend to read a lot, partly because I read for research. Mm-hmm. But then I am just really a book slut. I just have to be reading constantly. So on audiobook, I'm listening to The Master, which is about Henry James, and also a P.G. Woodhouse, because he's just so funny, about the antics of Bertie Wooster and Jeeves, and so on. What I've done for the last year and a half since my husband passed away is be reading books, listening to books on tape, one after the other.
I listen to a lot of audiobooks. My day job, I type orders for like a nursing home system. And so while I'm typing, I listen to a lot of audiobooks too. And it's a nice little companion. So I definitely know the interest in audiobooks. Like it's something I love.
The only problem is if the book is beautifully written, then I just can't listen to it like that because I want to pause and enjoy the phrase making and the imagery. So it doesn't really work for me to listen to, say, Virginia Woolf as an audiobook, or Edith Wharton, or Dylan Thomas, or any of the very high stylish writers, or Proust, for example. In that case, what I sometimes do for book club, and I do belong to a book group, I absolutely love it, is that sometimes I will listen to a book on tape first and then I'll read it on the page so that I will have read it twice.
Very cool. Very cool.
I sound like a seriously book obsessed person.
We read a lot too, no worries.
But it's really so wonderful to have friendly minds with you. I can't imagine going on a trip, for example, without having a couple of books packed. And I like reading books on the page as opposed to reading them on Kindle. There's nothing wrong with reading them on Kindle, but for me, I don't absorb as much. And I like the sensory experience of holding a book.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I'm a little torn. Sometimes I read on my Kindle, but I also read on like paper. I love a good, you know, a good actual book in your hands. Like it's a very different experience, but I do appreciate both. So I know what you mean.
Yes.
If readers liked Zookeeper's Wife, what other books would you recommend to them, like in the similar vein?
Well, that's hard for me because, of course, there are many books written about the Holocaust, but The Zookeeper's Wife comes at it from a different perspective, from the perspective of the animals and of compassionate heroism. So I don't know of other books like that. I enjoyed reading The Pianist back when, and I've read a lot of books by people who were in the Warsaw Ghetto, and those are very powerful. But I wouldn't recommend them necessarily as reading. All right, I'm going to just stop on that. Sorry, you said I could. So.
No, you're fine. That's fine. I mean, sometimes it's just hard. Right.
Yeah, it's very hard because I don't know of another book like it. They very tend cool. to be written differently.
I'm very curious, too, about going back to the beginning. You know, what first interested you in writing?
Oh, I was writing when I was very little. My mom told me that a friend of hers phoned her one day and said, "Marcia, I just think you ought to know that your daughter is talking to herself again as she's walking home from school." And yeah, that was true. I was making up stories and writing poems and trying to make the world sayable from as far back as I can remember. When I was 12, I thought it would be good to be a publisher or a reporter. So I started publishing my own little horse newspaper. It was all about horses. And I wrote each copy out in pencil by hand, and then I abandoned it because it was obviously going to be too tiring a profession if you had to write everyone by hand. And then about 2 years later, I thought, oh, well, I'll write a novel about a horse named Stormy and a girl who loves him. And that didn't quite work out. And then I thought I would write a spy novel. But you really needed to know about sex and violence, and I didn't know about either one at that point. So I abandoned that, and so it went. But I continued writing, mainly poetry, all the way along. And then when I was in high school, one day I was lying out in the sun in the summer with girlfriends, and they had put their boyfriend's names in tape, masking tape, on their backs, so that they would get a suntan and it would spell out the boy's name because we didn't know from tattoos. And I happened to be reading a newspaper and it had a little item in there that schizophrenic sweat smelled different. And I thought, oh my, this is fascinating. I'd been really so interested in learning about who we are, what the human condition is like, how we come to be the way we are. And I thought maybe when I go to college next year, what I'll do is study biopsychology. And so I went to Boston U in biopsychology. I got married and divorced within a year. And in that process, I transferred colleges. And when I transferred, the computer put me in English by mistake. So there I was at 18, someone who had been writing shyly but enthusiastically for her whole life, and I just assumed it was fate. And from there, applied to MFA programs and creative writing and like that.
Awesome. Well, with movies like Hidden Figures making waves at the box office, Antonina's story is another one of those like hidden voices, like the people you didn't know behind the scene were working behind the scenes during these crazy historical periods. How did you first hear about her and Jan's story, and what compelled you to share it?
I came to the story of the zookeeper's wife through the animals. I was writing for National Geographic at the time. I was writing about endangered animals, and I had heard that there were very ancient-looking horses running around the a forest in Poland, and that the forest itself was very ancient. It was the forest that the fairy tales that we have come from. And I wanted to see the horses. But unfortunately, National Geographic sent me to the South Pacific instead to write about seals. But I stayed interested in the horses. And over the next few years, I just kept pursuing it, reading a little more here, a little more there, and decided I'd really like to go to this forest. So I tried to get in touch with them, but of course I don't speak Polish. And I asked a neighbor who was born in Warsaw if she would help me email them, the park service. And she said that coincidentally, one of her uncles had been a vet at the zoo before the war. And so we got in touch with him by email. And he said that he thought that the zookeeper's wife from that time had kept a diary. We asked him to find it for us, and he did. And he sent it. My friend translated it. And then I discovered really what was going on, that it wasn't just a question of these ancient horses. There were a lot of very unusual endangered animals running around the forest. The zookeepers in Warsaw were taking home orphan animals from the forest and raising them right inside their home. And the more I read, the more I saw that the zookeepers were taking in escaping Jews from the ghetto also. And when I began to read more about Antonina's sensibility, what she was like, what her relationship with nature was like, with animals, how much she risked and how deeply, deeply empathic and compassionate she was, I just knew that I would have to share her story. We have so many different versions of what heroism is, but they all tend to equal violence. You know, even if you see a woman hero during wartime, you can bet that she's going to be larger than life. She's going to shoot people. She's going to be like a superhero. But it isn't always like that. There are a great many people out there who are compassionate heroes and who risk their lives every day to make life more livable for people who are in horrible situations. And that's what Antonina did. Her husband was heroic in a more traditional way. He was head of an underground unit, and he was the one who actually smuggled people out of the ghetto. Her form of heroism was not only to keep them alive and hide them whenever the Nazis came by, and that was often, but also to see if she could make sure that they survived the war with their humanity intact and not be so traumatized that they had no life left. And she worked very hard at that. She brought them all out after dark, and they were hiding in the different zoo cages, but she brought them into the villa, and there happened to be a pianist who was hiding there who played music. There were artists. They had dinner parties. They were frightened, of course. They were horrified by what was going on. But they had mutual support from one another. And there were also all of these crazy animals running around the house. So they had the innocent distraction of animals as well. And she was an extraordinary friend to them.
And it's obvious that you did an extensive amount of research to give us such a detailed insight into this slice of time. How do you approach a project that feels so massive?
I did a lot of research, but I happen to love research.
That helps.
I love learning about the world. So the research part is fun. This was challenging because how do you write in sensory detail about a time that is completely unfamiliar to you, and a place as well, that is, and you can't make anything up because I was writing narrative nonfiction. So what I did was read everything I could get my hands on. As I was saying earlier, I read books by people who were in the Warsaw Ghetto. They wrote down diaries of what was going on, and they hid them in milk churns. The milk churns were buried, and after the war, people found them. So we do have accounts of that. We have accounts by the rabbi in the ghetto. His sermons have come down to us, and people who did survive. I just read everything. But then I also went to Warsaw. Visited the zoo, was able firsthand to see what the experience of being there would be like. Fortunately, after the war, even though Warsaw was completely leveled, the citizens rebuilt the downtown area brick by brick according to Renaissance architectural drawings. So when I stood on Antonina's balcony in the middle of the zoo and I looked at the downtown, I saw what she saw. And I could learn about the behavior of the various animals in the zoo, what they smelled like. I could learn about what the navigation pattern of birds over Warsaw in 1929 was like. So I knew what she saw when she looked up. It was possible to learn an awful lot about the era, about her. For example, at one point in her diary, she says that she and her son hid in a Baltic lampshade store, and she doesn't describe it, but you can learn what they looked like, the lampshades of the era. So it was possible to set the scene a little bit in that way. And every time somebody speaks in the book, I'm quoting directly from Antonina's diaries or interviews that were done with her or her husband after the war, or testimonies that were given by people who hid at the zoo or people who knew them. So ultimately, it was possible to write the book in layers. I wanted to make it very vivid on the senses so that people could feel like they were right there and experience what Antonina was going through.
Wow. That's, yeah, just thinking about like trying to build the world, like that's incredible. What was the most fascinating part of your research? Like, is there anything you learned that really surprised you or that you didn't expect had happened during this time or anything like that?
There were a lot of things that surprised me, but I must say one of them was the Nazis' relationship with genetics. Hitler didn't invent the idea of a master race and trying to breed a master race of people. He got the idea from the American eugenics movement. It was very popular here, unfortunately, before the war. And he wanted the people who worked for him to not only breed what he considered pure Aryan people, and kill all the others. He also wanted pure Aryan animals and plants. So he sent a botanical commando squad all over the world to steal the best specimens from different botanical gardens and bring them back for breeding. And he was going to do the same with animals from all over. And the plan was to drain 100,000 acres of marshland in the Baltics, rip up forests, replant everything. You know, if you think about it, we worry about doing things like that now because of climate change, but he intended to essentially destroy and replant and rebreed the whole planet, just go from one country to another, getting rid of the genes of the people who live there and the animals and the plants and the crops and replace them with a Nazi version of them. I found that really surprising. I didn't realize that the Nazi lunacy went to that extreme.
That's one of the things that really stuck out to me in the book, actually, was their relationship with animals in general and the way that they sort of viewed them. And there was one line in the book where you talked about how some of the patients, or many of the patients, didn't get any pain medication or anesthesia, and yet somebody was punished for not giving enough of it to worms.
Yes, that's right. Even though children could be operated on without anesthesia.
I mean,
they had a paradoxical relationship with nature. They really did. You know, on the one hand, they were the greenest people imaginable. They led their time in environmentalism. And they really believed that animals were noble creatures, almost mythic. And humans, too, except for all the humans that they put in special categories. So that would be Slavs, Jews, Catholics, gay, handicapped, gypsies. They had quite a few, really. And they believed that they were related to people who had lived on Atlantis. And they were sending out expeditions to Tibet and different places, where their scientists could measure, like, the cheekbones of people. They were completely obsessed with it. And it was a mythology, really. Because Atlantis, really?
Yeah.
I know. It was absolutely preposterous. And yet, they took it to really maniacal extremes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the idea that a person is less than a worm, just that blew my mind. And actually, that kind of segues into my next question, because Zookeeper's Wife obviously deals with heavy subject matter. What do you do when you get overwhelmed by either the amount of information that you're sifting through or the morbidity of the story?
You have to be very careful where you hold yourself, where you position yourself as you're writing. So, for example, I was able to read the testimonies of the people who survived the war, the people living in the ghetto. I could do all of that. What I could not do was visit the camps. That would have been more than I could cope with. But I must say, when I heard that Jessica Chastain had gone to the camps, because she wanted to know what was at stake, what her character, Antonina, was really fighting for. That impressed me enormously. I knew that she was heart and soul invested in the film and in the woman's story.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And I want to get into some more of the book details first before we do talk about the movie, because we definitely have questions about the movie as well, which is looks really amazing. But a lot of the stories coming out of this period in time are about surviving. But I think it's interesting because this story is also about living. Antonina provides both the animals and the people that she cares for with entertainment and a life. And it begs the question, you know, what do you need to truly live? And I think that this book explores that theme a lot.
Yes, I'm very interested in that and what happens if you are overwhelmed by trauma and what kind of life might be possible afterwards. How do you cope with the trauma? How do you help people get through it? in some kind of vital way. And she was certainly very good at that. She tried to normalize life for them as much as possible. I don't think that it's an accident that she had all these people living in the house at the same time that she had so many wild animals living in the house. Partly, it helped with camouflage. The Nazis were walking through the zoo all the time, but there would normally be so many strange sounds and shadows. They knew the house was full of animals, and that was good camouflage for having people around. But more importantly, there is something funny and distracting and innocent about having animals around. These were therapy animals as well, and the house was full of them. And I think that was very helpful. There were children. The children were, of course, frightened, but nonetheless, they could socialize with each other. There was actually a baby born in the course of the war there. They tried to make the experience of being there as family-like as possible.
Yeah, and the animals, like, they almost allowed them to kind of hide in plain sight, which is another common theme with stories like this. And what does it say to those that were sympathetic to the Nazi cause that they often overlooked people right in front of them and just didn't see them? Like, it's almost like they chose not to see them.
That the Nazis chose not to see people, you're saying?
No, those, like, their neighbors, like the people that grew up next door to Jewish people. And as they all began, you know, to hide friends and to save people, Nazi sympathizers that existed in that area and in that period may have, you know, not purposely overlooked it, but like just missed them. Like they chose not to see them. You know what I mean?
Yes. It was a very interesting split that was going on. There was immense anti-Semitism among the Poles, among people all over. And at the same time, there was an enormous amount of sympathy and a lot of rescuers and hundreds of thousands of people who were risking their lives all the time to help Jews escape. It took a great number of people to get one person out of Warsaw safely and out of the country. Not to mention that they had secret universities going on and all kinds of underground things. My grandparents are Polish, and I had no idea, first of all, how strong a fight the Poles put up. But secondly, how many people were not sympathizers with the Nazis? How many people were disgusted by Nazi racism and just felt that the right thing to do, the moral thing to do, was to fight against it and was to help their neighbors survive?
Yeah, and I mean, that sort of begs the question too. You know, we'd all like to believe that we'd act as Antonina and Jan did if something like this ever happened in our time, but all humans have a survival instinct. You know, would most people's sense of right and wrong overcome their fear of death? And how do you think you'd react in a situation like this?
It's a question I asked myself all the time while I was writing.
I can imagine.
Would I have had this kind of courage, especially with children at home, because you're risking their lives too.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in your family would have been killed. And I don't know if I would have, but an interesting aspect of the rescuers, as they're called, is that if you read their accounts, and I read all of them from Poland, if you read their accounts, they say exactly the same thing. They say that they didn't do anything special. This is what Jan Szybinski said, too, that he didn't do anything special. that anyone in his situation would have done the same thing. It was the right thing to do. Now, it could be partly that for many of them, their religious upbringing informed their actions. I don't know. Jan was an atheist, I believe. Antonina wore a Catholic medal, so, and she had her children baptized, so maybe there was some of that that was motivating her, that she felt morally, religiously, this is what you do. But I think it has to do with some really mineral sense of morality that they have, that there's good and there's evil, there's right and there's wrong. And you need to do whatever is required to keep alive a necessary attitude about life and about respect and dignity.
Absolutely. Another interesting facet of this story is that Antonina and Jan are normal people who rise to heroism through simple acts of sympathy. What was it like uncovering all those little moments of decency in this crazy and just morbid time?
They are normal people, or were normal people. And that was something that I had seen personally during like 5 years or so, where I had volunteered as a suicide prevention and crisis telephone counselor. So, you know, when you call up the crisis service, there's an anonymous person at the other end of the line. And in my hometown, I was one of a large number of people who did that. All of the people who were the counselors were normal people. They weren't larger than life. They weren't more moral, more just, more insightful. They were people who just cared a lot about their neighbors, and it was neighbors helping neighbors. And this was also true for the Jabinskis, I think. And it happens a lot in wartime, where people who are otherwise normal people are inspired by events to reach deep inside of themselves and rise to the best that they can be. And it certainly was true for Antonina and Jan. I'm sure it's true all over our perpetually war-torn planet today.
One of my favorite things about Antonina is that she never felt inferior to her husband. In fact, she often feels his superior in her acts of compassion and her understanding of human and animal nature. Was this a point you were purposely trying to make as you wrote the story, or did it sort of just emerge as you told Antonina's tale?
That really just emerged. I was trying to stay very true to the woman. And fortunately, she wrote children's books in which she becomes mother animals and can protect her young and her kind in that way. So imaginatively, on many occasions, she had a sense of herself as very strong, very competent. Also, she was orphaned when she was quite little. Her parents were murdered in the early days of the Russian Revolution. So she was raised by her grandmother, and she became more independent maybe than a lot of kids do. And she was aware of her husband's strengths, and he certainly had a lot. And she was aware of her own and that they differed from his.
Another aspect that really kind of stuck out to me in this book was Antonina's ability to calm animals and to anticipate human behavior. And it almost came across as supernatural. What do you think is the cause of like it almost being, you know, larger than life, her ability to empathize?
Actually, that made very good sense to me. That spoke to me very, very closely, because all you really need to do is pay attention to the senses of animals to understand what kinds of things are going to frighten them. For example, if you have a horse, the eyes are on the side of the head because horses evolved as prey animals, and they needed to be able to see what was coming up behind them, you know, something stalking them. Humans have eyes right on the front of the head because we were the predators. We had to be able to spot our prey and track it very carefully as it moved in front of us and so on. But when you know things like that, you know how to not spook an animal. Or if you know which animals have a sense of smell or a sense of hearing, or which animals have a temperament that is more trusting or more skittish. She was very, very attentive to them. She really loved studying them. Both she and her husband were zoologists, and they just loved animals. And part of that meant that they were around animals all the time. They knew how they behaved. And in Antonina's case, it was accompanied by such a deep-seated love of animals. For her, she loved all animals, which included humans and other animals.
Now, of course, the reason why we get to do this amazing interview with you is because the movie is going to be coming out soon. It's going to come out March 31st, and the trailer is out there. It's a beautiful trailer. As soon as I watched it, I was instantly in love with this movie. I'm very excited to be able to watch it when it does come out. And you know, there are a lot of book adaptations coming out these days, and I was curious, do you typically read a book before you see its adaptation, or is it sometimes nice to go into a film with no expectations?
I like to read the book first because you get the internal life of the characters then, and that speaks to me. And also you get the descriptions of things. But it's also fascinating then to see the film, because what happens is that, well, in the case of Zookeeper, the events took place over the period of the war, over several years, but they had to be compressed into just a couple of years. And there are things which you can imagine, I can describe, but it's very powerful to actually see the characters stand up and walk off the page and do things and say things. It's just a different artistic experience. And part of the reason that I liked the film so much is that it stayed very true to the book, very true to Antonina's story, and yet it enriched the experience by making it possible to see it in a different way. So it just brought another angle onto it for me.
Yeah, book to film adaptations are clearly all the rage. There's a lot of them. What makes this adaptation, the adaptation of Zookeeper's Wife, different from a lot of the other ones we've seen?
I really can't tell you about the other adaptations so much, but what I can tell you is that the poetry of the filming is very sumptuous. I knew it was going to be when I heard that Nikki Caro would be the director. She directed Whale Rider, which is absolutely gorgeous. And she has a very poetic eye which for details, which is wonderful and really comes through. She also has a special gift for taking situations that in other hands could come across maybe as cliché, or because they're just so human, so familiarly human, and bring to them the individuality of the situation and of the character and make them absolutely fresh. I saw that in some of her other films, which I had been acquainted with. So I knew she was going to be terrific for it, and she directed it beautifully. And Jessica Chastain, Daniel Brühl, all of the actors really put their hearts into it. I was on the set for only 4 days, but in that time I watched them just wrap up their selves as if the self was nothing more than a sweater on a warm day, and lay down on the ground and just become this other person completely, wholeheartedly. The people who were involved with the film all got involved for the right reasons. I spoke with two women producers very early on. There was a woman screenplay writer, the woman director, the woman actress, a large number of women crew members. Everybody was involved for the right reasons. They identified with Antonina and felt that she was an important role model for our time, and that her story really needed to be kept alive.
And this is the first one of your books to be adapted for the screen. So how did it feel getting that news?
Oh, very exciting. But it took 8 years for it to go from discussions to finally come out. So as you know, these things can take quite a long time to happen.
Yeah.
I wrote a verse play a few years ago, and we staged part of it, and that was exciting. One of my other books was converted to a stage play on extended wings. And that was a different kind of experience, because there was an actress standing up on stage who looked nothing like me, but who was saying my words and sharing my thoughts. So that was unusual. And they're all very different experiences. And in each case, it allows you to see something with perspective that you might not have because you're overly familiar with it since you've worked on it for so long. So it's really a gift for me.
How much input did you have, like, in the whole movie-making process? Did you get to work with Angela Workman on the script, or were you just kind of, you know, excited to see your work come alive?
I didn't want to be involved writing the screenplay, because that's not my area of expertise, and I would rather that people who have a real gift for this and a lot of experience do it. So that wasn't something I wanted to be involved with, but I did read the script when it was written, and I thought it was wonderful. I knew about the director, the actors, all of that, but I was not hands-on in that sense. Again, because it's not my area of expertise, and I really appreciate the level of artistry that goes into different art forms. And on the set, of course, I met everyone. I explored everything. I was thrilled when I saw details in the staging or in the set design that I had written about in the book, and I heard people uttering the words that I had written. And it was very exciting to see the scenes being shot and how they were being interpreted. But I wasn't, I'm not a filmmaker. And I have enormous respect for what they do. It's not something I wish to do personally. I much prefer being a writer. I think I would find it daunting to be a filmmaker.
Yeah, they are very different art forms, so I can definitely understand that. Are there any specific passages or moments in the book that were left out of the movie that you wish hadn't been cut?
I don't think so. I can't remember any. As I say, I've seen the film twice. I don't think so. I think they included all of the important ones. I mean, the parts of the book that might be most meaningful to me maybe ones that have to do with contemplation, for example, where somebody is thinking about something or where I'm thinking about something. But you can't really do that in film in the same way. So that's just a very personal thing. But in terms of the scenes, no, I think they really captured it well.
I can imagine, too, that the sets must have been incredible because you put so much detail into the background and you describe, you know, like the scenes with the bug collection and everything and the way that you describe all of that, like it's so vivid in my mind. I can imagine that seeing that on set, seeing all of that set up where you spend pages describing it and then it coming to life must have been breathtaking.
It was breathtaking, but especially it impressed me with the amount of labor and devotion that went into reproducing it. There, of course, were special set designers, and oh my goodness, they do such meticulous work in recreating an era.
You did mention that you've seen the movie twice, and I'm curious what scenes really stood out to you in the movie that were the most powerful and maybe, as the author, affected you the most to actually see on screen?
Those would be the facial expressions of the actors in a variety of intensely emotional scenes, not just one or two. But bear in mind, that's not something, there's something I could imagine as I was writing the book, but to physically see that, to see them relating to each other, just blew me away. I think all of the scenes were very powerful. It's compelling from start to finish. It was a deeply unnerving and thrilling and horrifying and gratifying and enriching time to be alive. It was, as they say, the best of times and the worst of times.
Mm-hmm.
The best because you discover the goodness of people as well as the evil. And you discover that fear means that you really pay attention from moment to moment because every detail matters. It may have to do with whether you live or die. And so you are never more alive than in wartime, in this kind of situation. That's part of the reason that soldiers return from war and report that was the peak of their lives. It was a time of enormous intensity for them. This is also true in what went on in Poland during that time and at the zoo. They had to be careful every single second. That doesn't mean that they didn't also have fun. They did. And that there wasn't an enormous amount of love. There was. The intensity of emotions was very powerful, and it's powerfully conveyed in the movie through the actors and the way that they are responding to one another. And so that moved me the most, not just Jan and Antonina, but Lutz Heck. And this very complicated relationship that he had with Antonina, I won't give anything away. But I read Lutz Heck's autobiography and learned a lot about him when I was writing the book. And the emotions were complex that he was feeling, and also on Antonina's side. And it was really lovely to see those flickerings traveling between the two people. So that's all I'll say on that, I think.
The experience with the movie sounds like it was fantastic for you. Would you do it again, or is once enough? Would you like to see one of your other novels adapted?
Well, first of all, it's not a novel. It's nonfiction.
Right.
Yeah. I'd love to see 100 Names for Love adapted. That is an altogether different kind of story. I wrote it after my late husband had had a stroke and lost all of his language, and we had to somehow reinvent life, marriage, everything. And he had a very strong will, and I did too. And between the two of us, we just worked on bringing him back to language over a period of about 5 years. And it's a very special kind of love story. So I don't know how I would feel seeing myself and seeing him played by other people. I sometimes wonder how John Bailey might have felt seeing himself and his wife, Iris Murdoch, in the film Iris, that was done about their lives. But it turned out to be really beautiful, as was the book he wrote about their lives and what how it evolved when she got dementia.
Well, I just want to say The Zookeeper's Wife was a fantastic book, and I recommend all of our listeners to go check it out. Kristen and I actually both listened to the audiobook as well, which was superb. Absolutely fantastic narration there. Really brings the story alive, so also highly recommended. Again, the movie comes out.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
Yes. Again, the movie comes out March 31st, so we hope our listeners will not only read the book, but go see the movie too, because it looks like it's going to be really good. Great cast, great people behind the cameras. Highly anticipating this one. And thank you so much for coming on to Book Hype and having this discussion with us.
Yes, thank you very
much. It's my pleasure. Lovely talking with you today.
You as well. And to all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in once again, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.